This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, men and women who have put their lives on the line for our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, boy, do we learn a lot. We are educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman we're going to hear from today is 91 years young, originally from Minnesota by way of Canada, a high schooler in Bend, Oregon, but for the last quarter century here in Clovis, California, where he's still serving, and we'll tell you about that, what he's up to these days. George Hansen, my guest today, veteran of the 11th Armored Division in World War II, recipient of the Purple Heart. But long before that, just a young guy following your dad around in the lumber business. You saw quite a bit of the northern U.S. and Canada as a youngster, didn't you?
I really did. I saw lumber camps and saw how they take the lumber and put it into boards and sell it to people.
And you told me you really wanted to be a pilot. When did that dream of getting up in the sky and fighting enemies or just flying, when did that originate?
When I was young in Canada, we lived on a lake and there was a dock and planes would land there in the wintertime on skis, in the summer on pontoons. And I thought, I want to be a pilot someday. And the desire grew and grew till I became a pilot.
Tell me what you remember about being in high school in Bend, Oregon. And maybe some folks have been through Bend. Maybe they've gone skiing over there at Mount Bachelor or something. But what was it like back then in the late 30s and early 40s?
Well, it was a dirt road up to where the ski area is now. And we used to go up there for camping and just for hiking. And then later on, after I got out of the Army, I went there to Mount Bachelor to go skiing.
What were you into in high school? I know you're still playing this French horn over here now. Were you doing that back then?
Yeah, my mother wanted me to try to get in a band, so I got in the orchestra, and they said, here, take a French horn and play the French horn. So that's where I got started on a French horn.
And you're still playing?
I still play. For 40 years, my horn was in the closet, and then my church started an orchestra. And I got the horn out of the closet, and I'm still playing there about 10 years later.
Are you the oldest one in the orchestra at 91? Is there someone who's got you beat?
There was one guy a year and a half older who just died, so now I am the oldest.
Outstanding. Well, don't slow down on that. So you graduated in 1941, and about 6 months later, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Every veteran I've talked to seems to have a memory of December 7th, 1941. What do you remember about that day?
I was in Los Angeles going to Westmont College, which was there at the time, and I'll never forget Pearl Harbor. And then the city started blackouts, so at night there wouldn't be a lot of lights on, and you'd wonder if the Japanese were going to come and bomb Los Angeles, which they never did.
Well, some people may know Westmont is now in Santa Barbara, which was the one spot on the California coast that actually was hit by the Japanese at that point. Santa Barbara took a couple shells, but what I've heard from people who were in L.A. at the time was, like you say, blackouts and concern that Japanese bombers might be coming. Is that something that was real to you, that you expected something like that to happen?
Well, we knew it could happen, but I don't think I ever really thought it would happen.
Well, thankfully, it didn't. And you're there at Westmont, but we've already talked about it. You had this dream of being a pilot, and you tried to do something about that, didn't you?
Well, they didn't want me in the Air Force because I'm colorblind, but after I got out of the Army, I discovered that you can get a private pilot's license. I could never be a commercial pilot, which is fine with me now, but I could get a pilot's license, which I did. I still like to fly, but I haven't flown for 2 or 3 years now.
So it was just a dream delayed when the Army Air Corps said, no, colorblind, we can't take you. And the Navy kind of told you the same thing. So was that a disappointment to you at the time? Here you are trying to go serve your country, and they say no thanks?
No, it was a disappointment. But I've discovered that God has something better, and it's not always what we want. It's what he shows you that you should be doing.
So finally, Uncle Sam said, hey, we want you now. We want you in the Army. But as folks have heard from some other veterans on this program, you entered a training program, the Army Specialized Training Program, which was really going to college and training a little bit, but really studying a lot. And you were studying engineering at Santa Clara?
That's right, for about 6 months. And then they decided they don't need any more engineers, so they just went down to Lompoc, which was the 11th Armored Division training place, getting ready to go overseas, and we just filled in empty spots. And I had never dreamed of being in a machine gun squad, but there I was, now assigned to a machine gun squad.
Had you ever fired a machine gun before?
Never. Although I grew up with guns and loved to go hunting in Oregon, and so I'm familiar with guns, but not a machine gun.
So here you are. You're not even 20 years old yet, but you're facing the prospect of heading overseas in a machine gun squad. Did that sound like a dangerous job, dangerous duty for you?
You know, I don't think I thought too much of the danger till later on. However, I always wanted to be involved in this war, and all the young guys wanted to be in some kind of service, Navy or Army or Air Force or Coast Guard or something. And so everybody was for you, and our country wasn't divided. We were all together wanting to win these two wars.
And what was it for you personally that made you so motivated, that drove you to want to go do something?
I think it was part of our culture. Most young guys wanted to go and get involved because we thought it was something that was for the good of our country. And then I've always kind of liked adventure and new exciting things. And to me, it was exciting.
Well, and you would get more than your share of excitement over there in Europe. And you've lived quite an exciting life since then. And I guess I should touch on something chronologically here. Because since you made it home from World War II, since you're able to meet your wife and have all your children, and now you've got 13 grandchildren and working on great-grandchild number 10, you had to survive all the war to do that. But your life after the war involved the ministry. And there was something that happened that I guess kind of was a spark in terms of you getting into the ministry. Do I have that right?
Yes. You know, when I got to England and they said any day we're going to France, and that's where people were getting killed. During my high school years, sometimes they would ask young people like me if we were willing to be a pastor or a missionary. And I always thought, well, that's fine. I love pastors. I love missionaries. But I want to be a pilot. I want to get in the Air Force and have the excitement of flying an airplane. So that was my desire, which didn't work because I'm colorblind. They didn't want me. They don't want colorblind pilots stopping, landing when the red light is blinking at the end of the runway. So I just waited till I was drafted, and then, as I mentioned, I ended up in the infantry.
But I think you started to tell me, so you get over there in Europe, and this is 1944. You went over to England in September of 44, and 6 weeks later, you were heading over to France. Before you went across that channel, you did something that so many guys have done. Some have regretted it. Some have been thankful for it, but you made a bargain with God?
Yeah, I don't know if you should make bargains with God, but I did. I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything with the rest of my life that you want me to do. I'd even be a preacher. I'd even be a missionary. And so God heard me, and he started answering my prayer in different ways.
Well, and we're going to hear about some of those ways. And I don't know if you were exaggerating, but I know you told me you could count at least 7 times where you felt your life was spared during your time in World War II. So I know we all want to hear about some of those. But do you remember, aside from that little conversation with God there, do you remember what your anticipation was, or the feeling that you had before your first taste of combat?
You know, somehow, and I think everybody hopes that they won't be the one that gets killed or even injured, but I just sort of had a gut feeling that this won't happen to me. I'll make it.
So you told us a machine gun squad with the 11th Armored Division. What was your specific role in that squad?
Okay, they have 3 guys indicated. The squad leader uses the 50 caliber machine gun. Then 2 guys in the back where you have 9 guys in 2 rows. 2 of them have a machine gun. The rest of us just have a rifle. like a regular foot soldier.
Where was your first taste of combat? What do you remember about those moments?
I remember that one night we were heading towards the city of Bastogne, and we stopped at night and went to sleep on the ground next to a haystack. And we thought, well, we'll have a good night's rest here by this haystack. And about 10 o'clock, the captain says, we're moving out. So we got in our armored column, tanks in the front, and then half tracks with machine gun squads and other foot soldiers, and we're headed for Bastogne.
And tell us why it was so important to get to Bastogne, because the timing of this was the Battle of the Bulge, right?
That's right, and there were hundreds of soldiers there surrounded by Germans, and our goal was to go and rescue them. So we're on the way up there, and I'm in the back riding along, a couple tanks in front, and then behind us other trucks with more soldiers. And all of a sudden, about 11 o'clock at night, this explosion wakes up the guys like me that were sort of dozing in the back as we went along in this armored column. And it was an explosion. A German shell had come and landed right in the middle of the nine of us in the back. The explosion woke us up if we were asleep. And I immediately felt that my leg on my left side was, I thought it was blown off. So I started feeling to see where it ended. And I got to my foot, and I was very happy that I still had a foot and a leg. But it was numb from the explosion, which ripped off my overcoat that had a hand grenade in it and a camera I carried. And I couldn't feel a thing. But they said, get out of this vehicle fast. So I got out. And, you know, isn't it interesting how God treated me? There was a medic's jeep right behind our vehicle. The nurses or whoever they were, guys with first aid caps on their head, they took me in this jeep to a field hospital, and then the next day to a hospital where I spent a few weeks in a warm room having meals in bed being treated by American nurses. And I thought, wow, am I ever blessed to be alive and to be here? While the rest of my buddies were for 2 days pinned down by the German artillery, sleeping in the snowbanks.
Yeah, you talk about something that could have saved your life, maybe being shaken up and wounded, and you did get the Purple Heart for that incident. Maybe that did save your life. And more about that shell, so we can understand how amazing it is that you did survive as intact as you were. You said it tore your overcoat off, smashed all the contents, and it also put a hole in the floor of this metal half track?
That's right. And sitting right next to me, it was very snug back there with all of us together with our heavy overcoats on and a gun in our hand. The guy next to me was killed immediately. They said it kind of blew up his insides. And the one sitting across from him who's my feet were touching was also killed immediately, and a couple others were wounded. So when a few weeks later when I went back to my organization, it was a new bunch of replacements except for two or three guys of the 12, and the captain says, George, now you are the squad leader. So I took over as the squad leader.
Wow. I know you've lived with that for more than 70 years, but is it a little hard for you to believe that the guy on either side of you, the guy to your right and the guy to your left, they're both killed, that you think you lost your leg, but you didn't, it's intact, and you didn't even bleed?
Well, you know, I said, God, if you get me out alive, I'll do anything. And I began to think, well, he kept me alive through this, and I wonder what's next.
And you said you spent 3 weeks in hospitals as opposed to the worst winter that Europe had ever seen out there in the foxholes. But what were those 3 weeks like? What kinds of things were going through your mind, and how did you occupy your time?
I really don't remember. I just looked forward to the next meal, which they brought me in bed. And then about a week before I left, I finally could get up and walk. And I remember walking down the street in this town in France, and I noticed a sign of an honor thing for Joan of Arc, and discovered that Joan of Arc, who was one of the French heroes in the past, this was the town where she grew up and lived.
You mentioned having to be able to walk again. Did it take 3 weeks to get the feeling back in your leg, to have that coordination again?
I think after the first week, the feeling was really really coming back, but I think my leg must have been somewhat swollen, evidently, because they wouldn't let me go till I could walk with ease.
It's time to catch our first break, but there are more close calls, more examples of what this 91-year-old pastor and missionary sees as divine protection as he fought the rest of the war in Europe. You'll find photos of George Hansen then and now on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 91-year-old George Hansen of Clovis, California. Born in Minnesota, raised in Canada, and then in Oregon, he would return to Oregon after a quarter century as a missionary in South America. In fact, if you're listening today on 1430 KYKN in Salem, Oregon, maybe you remember him as the pastor of a church there in Salem. His decision to enter the ministry stems from his time in the Army during World War II, serving with the 11th Armored Division in Europe. We heard about how he was nearly killed by a German artillery shell during the Battle of the Bulge. When he recovered from those injuries, he returned to his machine gun squad, now as squad leader. How'd you feel about that? You're what, 20 years old?
I don't remember what I thought, but I thought, well, that's kind of nice. Now I get to sit in the front and go first and handle this 50 caliber machine gun, which I had never fired before.
Never fired before, 20 years old. You've already been hurt and in the hospital before you'd ever tasted combat. I mean, that was your first encounter with the Germans. You got hurt. I think a lot of guys would be shaking in their boots. What was your state of mind?
I think I was very happy because I got to go in the front of the vehicle now.
That's closest to the enemy, don't you know?
I guess I didn't think about that.
In all honesty, do you look at those 3 weeks? Because those are three fierce weeks of fighting. I mean, those 3 weeks are the rest of the Battle of the Bulge, where so many were killed and so many are wounded. What do you think would have happened if you had stayed out there with your unit instead of being in the hospital?
You know, I don't think about it much, but I know what the ones that did stay went through. They went through a lot of opposition, and then they finally broke through the German defense and restored those guys, which was wonderful because they'd been trapped there for several weeks by now.
But in the process, many of them were killed, many of them were wounded, many of them came back with frozen feet because the conditions were so brutal. We've heard from you already how thankful you are, but there's still a lot of war left here. I mean, we've got another 4 or 5 months of this war in Europe. So where did you guys go from there, and what were some of the things you experienced?
Well, the first assignment as a squad leader now was that we got up about two or three in the morning, and the captain said, George, your squad is going to go on this path that goes up to a line of pillboxes that we had captured and the Germans had recaptured, and now we're going to go capture this line of defenses again. You'll go up and your trail will lead you to one of these pillboxes, and your assignment is to go and recapture that from the Germans. So when it was still dark, we were walking up this trail headed for that pillbox that we're supposed to recapture. And what happened was, when we were about 50 yards, you could see it. The light was starting to get light. You could see this row of concrete pillboxes, which are they're kind of rounded, and they're a place for defending any enemy that might come. And right in the front, there's a slot where they can shoot with their machine gun. But as we got up close, they said, stop. And the artillery, the American artillery behind us, started shooting shells. And these shells were landing all around these concrete defenses, pillboxes, they called them. Then they says, okay, the artillery has stopped. Now you go up there and get them. So I led my squad, and we went up, and there were two Germans in a foxhole right in front of this defense that we were supposed to retake. And these shells had landed right around them. They were really scared to death. And when they saw me coming with these other guys, they held up their hands and surrendered. So I went up, and I said, give me your guns. And one of them had a rifle and a pistol. And I said, I'll take your pistol, please. And my wristwatch had been destroyed in that explosion. And I said, I'll take your wristwatch, too. I need a clock, and I need a pistol. So that's where I got my first pistol of 8 that I ended up with. So they surrendered. And by the time that happened, others had taken over the pillbox. We went around on the back end of it where there's a door going into the defense thing. And we stayed there for a day. But an exciting thing happened. When I looked back at it, I could see that somehow God knew where I should walk, because the captain came to me and he said, George, there's a little hill here, which you can see right behind this defense. And I want you to go up on top of that hill and get a flat place and get one of your machine gun guys to put the machine gun up there, because right across a little valley, you could see a little city. And he said, that's where the Germans are, and they might attack us any minute. So get your guys to put a machine gun up there, and so we'll be ready to defend ourselves. So I walked up this little dirt path and cleared a little flat place for the machine gun. And I went down, and the captain said, you've been up most of the night. Go inside and take a nap. So I did. But before I did, I told the two guys, one carries the machine gun, the other carries a box of ammunition. I said, you guys go up there. I marked the place to put the machine gun. And I went inside this defense and laid down. And about 10 minutes later, they carry some guy in who's screaming. And then they brought another guy in that was screaming with pain. And then they brought a third one in, and I discovered what had happened. The guy carrying the machine gun goes up the trail I had just walked on, and he stepped on a landmine, and it blew off his left foot. So there he is laying, and his buddy that was carrying the ammunition goes to help him. He stepped on a second landmine, and it blew his right foot off. And a lieutenant who saw the two of them laying there crying went to help him. He stepped on a third landmine. And it kind of exploded in his face. His face was all bloody. And there they were. And soon the doctor, the nurse, the guys that are there to help, took them away. And I have no idea where they took them, but probably to a hospital. And then I thought, you know, I walked in that same path. I wasn't even thinking about landmines. And I thought, well, God, you spared my 2 feet again. And what a wonder.
How wide was that path?
Oh, it's just like a lot of paths you see for shortcuts through the woods or across an empty lot, maybe 2 feet, 2 or 3 feet wide at some places.
But somehow you avoided at least 3 landmines, if not more, that hadn't been set off.
That's right. That apparently they just had 3 right there in one section of the path.
I don't know. I've been reminded of a few passages of scripture already while you're talking, but that one reminds me of Proverbs 3:5-6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he'll direct your path. So I think we're up to two occasions already where you felt like God spared your life, and you hadn't been over there that long. Did you ever get to a point where you said, I don't know if this can keep happening? I don't know if I can keep cheating death the way I am?
I don't remember if I even thought that. I just somehow thought, well, like I see someone with a flat tire today on the freeway, and I think, well, that's not going to happen to me. And I think that was my attitude. This won't happen to me. I'll make it.
And you told that story about the machine gun and the guys who were setting it up, hitting all the landmines. I would think the other reality is that if you're manning a machine gun, you're quite a target for the enemy. You're one of the first guys they want to take out. Did you have some times where you experienced that, where you were singled out, or the enemy rounds or shells started heading your way?
Well, the very next day, the captain said, we're going to go across his little valley and capture these Germans, hopefully. And so on the way into that town, nothing happened, but we got in the town, and he says, okay, get out of your vehicle and dig foxholes. And we did. Funny how fast you can dig a hole when you think there's a shell coming. And we no sooner got our foxholes dug than the shells started landing all around us. And one of them landed about, 5 feet from me, which was the foxhole of one of my friends. And it hit right on the edge of the foxhole. Pretty soon the shells quit coming. And one by one, my buddies started popping their heads out of their foxhole. Except this one guy that's about 4 feet from me. And you could see where the shell landed, right on the edge of the hole. And he didn't come out. And the guy says, okay, Hansen, you got to go look and see what's left of him in there. So I'm getting out of my foxhole, and just then he pops his head up, and I'll never forget what he said. He said, a miss is as good as a mile. And what happened, the shell landed, and the shrapnel all flies out horizontally to the right and left, but if they would have been a couple inches closer, he would have been like hamburger.
So there's a situation where he escapes, and that's a big relief. But you mentioned before the time with the landmine where all those guys are injured. Was it hard for you to deal with losing friends, losing guys in your squad, guys that were either killed or were wounded and had to go home?
It is hard, but I guess they kept us busy, so you're on to the next assignment, whatever that'll be, in the next day. Keep going.
While you were over there, did you ever hear from home?
Well, my mother would send letters, and she says, I'm just praying that God will somehow protect you. And that was always an encouragement to know that my mother was there at home praying for me.
How did you feel about the enemy, the Germans you were fighting?
You know, one day the captain says, okay, George, there's a machine gun squad out here. You go get them. So we walked across a little valley and came up by an orchard. As I came up where I could take a look, I could see this German with a machine gun pointing, but he was defending another road that came into the city. We came a different road, and we were coming from the side, and there he was pointing his machine gun on this road, and I could have shot him right in the head, but I didn't want to kill Germans. I didn't hate Germans. So what I did, I shot right at the top of his helmet, and it must have nicked it because it scared him to death. And he didn't know where I was till he looked and saw me with a gun pointing at him. And he put up his hands and surrendered. But I didn't want to kill him. I could have, because I didn't hate Germans. And I knew that they're the enemy, but I don't hate them, really.
Well, and you wonder, it would be interesting to know what happened to him, what life he led since his life was spared.
Then he came towards me, and on his way he says, Franz, Fritz, wake up. Evidently they had spent the night there, and the other guys were in foxholes, one about 3 feet away from me, and he stuck his rifle up with a white handkerchief tied to it. And I was shocked because I didn't know he was that close. And we captured the whole squad that mostly was sleeping when we got there. And then we sent them back, and we said, okay, I guess that's our job for the day. And the captain or someone, you know, we didn't have walkie-talkies or telephones. So the captain had one guy that would be his runner, and he'd give him a message, and he'd run up to wherever I was and tell us. So he said, oh, there's another machine gun squad across that road over there. Go get it now. So I said, okay. I said, you guys cover me, and I'll run over there and look. So I ran across the street and went up in it was a farmhouse right on the edge of town. I kicked the door open, went in the house. Nobody there. I thought, I'll go upstairs. And so I'm standing by the front door, and right to my left then was about 3 steps up to a landing, and then the stairway turned and went upstairs. So I went up to the landing where I'd just been by the front door, which had gone shut, And I look out the window, and here is this machine gun squad. They're coming running from the back of the house, and now they're running up the steps on the veranda, seven of them. And the guy in front has an automatic rifle, and he's shooting at the door. The bullets are coming through the door where I had just been standing. And I'm thinking, what do I do now? When they come through the door, should I surrender or should I shoot them one by one?
Were you all alone?
I was all alone. So I don't remember. It all happened so fast. All of a sudden, to my amazement, they did an about face and started running away from the house down toward the row of other houses. And what made them turn around? I still ponder and wonder why, if they would have come in, there I was all alone. But they didn't. And so I thought, well, I'll get my guys together. We'll go chase them wherever they are. And just then, one of my guys says, the captain says to come back. We're going to leave. So I never found out what happened to that German machine gun squad. I went upstairs and started shooting at them, and they ducked between some houses. And it was just about then that I was called to go.
How many lives were you supposed to get over there? Are you part cat? What's going on here? And you probably still had a few months to go after that. Did you guys have indications that victory was getting close? Did you feel that that was almost about to happen?
Well, the fact that this one machine gun squad all surrendered makes me wonder now. At the time, I don't know if I knew, but the captain told us to get in our vehicle, and we drove it down to the center of the city. And then we got out and walked. And what we would do to take over a city, half of my squad would go on one side of the street and the other half on the other. And we'd check out buildings as we went to see if there were soldiers hiding. And as I'm walking along, a machine gun, it must have been upstairs in the house, opened fire on me. And you know, the stores are built right out by the sidewalk. And I looked up and I could see a whole row of machine gun bullets hitting this wall, like the guy had kind of take a sweeping motion shooting, but just above my head a few inches. And so I ran across the street, and we called up a tank to come up, and those tanks, they're vicious. They can knock a house down. I never found out what happened to whoever that machine gun guy was shooting at me, but I have often wondered, did God make him shoot too high instead of right through my head? So once again, God spared my life.
There seems to be a pattern developing here, and as George recognized that pattern, it would lead to his post-war career. We'll listen to how that part of the story unfolds when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
This is Hometown Heroes. Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is 91 years old, but he really doesn't sound like it, does he? Purple Heart recipient George Hansen served in a machine gun squad with the 11th Armored Division, part of Patton's 3rd Army in Europe in World War II. Speaking of, what'd you think of him, General Patton, old blood and guts?
You know, to me, he was a hero. I only saw him once as we were in an armored column. I saw him standing on a hill looking with binoculars to the front. And you could see one of his pistols on his right side. And there he is looking through binoculars. That's as close as I ever got to him. But we respected him.
Was his bravado something that fired you guys up a little bit? Did it help you believe that you were capable of the things he thought you were capable of?
Oh, yeah. He was a great guy. I just finished reading O'Reilly's book about who killed Patton and learned a lot more about the whole picture, which we didn't know about at the time.
Well, I don't want to leave out any more of those close calls or those instances where you feel that God spared you, so feel free to jump in with any of those. But VE Day, where were you guys when you found out that Germany had surrendered?
We were on the Danube River in Austria and looked across the river, and we could see the Russians who had arrived. So that's where. And of course, we knew it was coming. The last few days, we could see that the Germans were retreating, the last towns. But they always left as they retreated, some people like machine gunners, to slow us down. And I know walking into one town, as we came in, it was a dirt road, and one of those machine gunners was shooting at me, and I could see the bullets splattering around my feet, but not one hit my foot. And once again, I thought, wow, that's pretty neat. That guy wasn't very good at shooting people.
Did you guys celebrate that news at all, that Germany had surrendered?
You know, I don't remember celebrating. Of course, we were happy. And then my first assignment after that was to stay on a farm, the 12 of us, and we took over this farmhouse. And our job was to collect German soldiers that might not have heard that the war was over. And some of them were separated, and they'd be in the woods or somewhere hiding. And then one by one, they'd come out, and we would take them back to headquarters for interrogation. And that was wonderful. On this farm, right in the bottom of the Swiss Alps, and they had horses. I've ridden a horse a couple times, but for 2 weeks we were there, and we would take turns taking a horse and just riding in the hills. A wonderful vacation.
You mentioned collecting prisoners. You were also collecting some stuff to bring home. You mentioned all the pistols and the sword that you still have around here. How did you end up with all that contraband or all those spoils of war?
Well, we were allowed, we shouldn't go taking other things, which sometimes we did, but guns and anything armored we could take. And that night that I slept in the prison of Germany's home, he had all kinds of swords and daggers and guns, hunting rifles. I took some of the swords from that place and put them in my half track. Then I got other like daggers and guns that I picked up here and there.
What comes to mind when you look at those now?
Well, they were a big help to me because I always wanted to take flying lessons, and I sold this this Luger, which is one of the top German pistols. I sold it for $500, which was enough to get me started in pilot training later on.
Funny how that worked out. One thing that's interesting, because people have different stories or different ways that they found out or different levels of understanding about this, but as you were fighting over there, at what point did you become aware of what the Nazi regime had been doing to the Jewish people and to some of these other political prisoners or persecuted peoples who were in the concentration camps being killed or tortured?
Well, one of the guys in my squad was Jewish, and he had a hatred for Germans that was very strong. And I can understand why, because maybe some of his relatives had been in all those persecutions and even killed. He never told me a lot of details, but I knew he had a powerful hate against Germans.
So you're aware of what's going on, and I know your division liberated a couple of the camps. You weren't part of that, but you did get to see some of the other prisoners, the American prisoners who'd been POWs, and some of the other folks who'd been forced into forced labor at that time?
During the last weeks or days of the war, the Germans had all but given up, and we in this armored column would go by, and I still remember this place where they had American prisoners, and the guys came out and shouted. We didn't even stop, but they were up there on a little hill just waving, and you could tell they were so happy. And then we came across a field that was mostly Hungarians. I have no idea why they were locked in this field, but they would jump up and down with excitement. And one of those really bad camps where they were later killed, I don't remember if we passed one of those or not. But all during this time, I had a growing desire to someday be a missionary, and I wanted first to go to Europe, where I see all the destruction and upheavals and how Jews are treated. I wanted to go there as a missionary and teach people about God's love. And that's why when the war ended, my mind was decided I wanted to be a missionary somewhere and help people like these poor people that I saw over there.
Well, you didn't have much choice after that deal you had made before the war, huh?
Yeah, but this time I didn't feel like it was something I had to do. Now it's something I want to do, and that's the way God works.
So you come back here to the States, you finish up at Westmont before going to seminary, and I guess it's a pretty good thing that you went back to Westmont, because you had to encounter a certain someone, didn't you? What do you remember about how you met Joyce.
Well, you know, some guys wanted to get married before they went overseas so they'd have a taste of marriage before the end. I had no desire, but now I did. And I still remember going to Westmont and seeing this blonde girl in the line. We'd go through the line and they'd serve us our dinner all dished up. And I thought, I'd like to meet that gal, which I arranged a way to meet her.
How'd you pull that off?
Well, just went and talked to her and asked her what her name was and found out a little bit about her. And from there on, it was a growing friendship. And one day I asked her if she ever wanted to be a missionary, and she said, nope. And I said, well, if God showed you that was what he wanted you to do, would you be? And she says, I believe I would. So we got married. That was my proposal.
You made her quite a deal there. Well, and that would be what the future held for you, because you two would become missionaries and spent 24 years in Brazil. I know it's probably hard to condense 24 years into a few minutes, but can you give us a taste of what you experienced there, what fulfillment you drew from it, and what all those years taught you?
Well, we went to a city way up on the top of Brazil, just south of the equator, a city of about 10,000 people. We went there to start a church. And it was a town where the Bible was a forbidden book. And sometimes when these Bibles were given away or sold, they would be collected by religious leaders. One little boy one day saw them being burned on a street corner, Bibles. But that's the kind of place I wanted to go. So we would give a portion of this Bible, like the Gospel of John, to people and say, hey, do you want to read the Bible? One by one, people would read it, and a lot of them became interested, became Christians. But the knowledge of Jesus was really not known. In fact, for 2 years, I didn't have a car, and then I got a used American World War II Jeep. Now I could go out of town, and I picked up this guy who was hitchhiking, and he got in the car, and he said, oh, I'm only going about a mile down the road, so that bit will really help to have a ride. So I thought, I better talk to him about Jesus pretty soon. I didn't know where to start, so I said, do you know why Jesus died? And he said, I can still remember how he said it in Portuguese. He said, I didn't even know he was sick. I found out later that Jesus is a name that some parents gave kids. But his knowledge was zilch. He didn't know anything about Jesus. And I thought, that's why I'm here. And what a blessing to be in a place where you can tell people who Jesus really is.
In those 24 years in Brazil, did you ever have days where you said, what in the world am I doing here? I'm not cut out for this?
My wife had those feelings more than I did. In fact, there was a plane that went by our town most every night. It was picking up people from along the coast and going to the big city of Belém, which is on the mouth of the Amazon. And then they would catch a big plane to the States. My wife said she was often tempted to jump on that plane. But those were just some of those days when things got a little tough.
I imagine you're going to be pretty interested in the Olympics next year.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I was there. We took a team of people from my church in June. That was last year. And we didn't go to Rio, for which I was thankful. We went to the last city I lived in, which is in the state of São Paulo. And what we did do, we would go to the games, but not to see the players. We would go there, and people were out celebrating and walking, and we'd offer them a portion of the Bible or gospel tracts and just talk to people on street corners. We did that for several of the big games.
This is the World Cup.
World Cup. Uh-huh. Most of them stayed in a school dormitory, but I stayed in the home of some Brazilian friends I had. And so when I get home today, I'd see some of the games on TV.
Well, are you going back for the Olympics then? I mean, you were 90 when you went for the World Cup, but you'll be 92 for the Olympics.
You know what? I love Brazil, and I'd go there anytime. I just need the money to pay the passage and a reason to go. And I'm always looking for a reason.
Well, and you're always looking for something to do here in the States as well. You've been here in Clovis, California for more than 20 years, and you're continuing to serve at River Park Bible Church. You told us you play the French horn in the orchestra. I know that's fun, but you're a lot busier than that. You're all over the place going to see people and try to comfort them. Tell me what your role is now at River Park Bible Church.
Well, you know, I fill in here and there and little things, but I guess the one I use the most time for is visiting people. Like today, I know of one guy who's going in for shoulder surgery. I know another guy from our orchestra that's got some bad stomach-type problem. He's in another hospital, and I plan to go see him today just to encourage them and have prayer together.
Why do you keep doing that? Because some people say, hey, when I hit 65, maybe even younger, I'm retiring and I'm not working anymore. Maybe they do that at 70 or 75. Here, you're 91, and you're still doing the same kind of work you've been doing for all these years.
Well, it's not work. It's pleasure. But also, I have more free time now than I used to have. There's some days when I can stay at home and do what I want to do, play the piano a little bit or work on my French horn or just read books.
Where does your motivation come from? What keeps you visiting people and ministering to people, and how long are you going to do that?
Well, you know, Paul mentioned Proverbs 3:5-6, and it says, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart." I think that means when you accept Jesus as your Savior. And then it says, in all you do, acknowledge Him, include God in your plans. And I haven't always done that. And even today, sometimes I don't check out how I spend my time with God to make sure it's a worthy thing, a way to spend time. But it says, if you trust Him, He will direct your path. And I think I'm where God wants me to be. And God has blessed me with so many wonderful friends. I was just amazed when I got back from Washington last week that all the people from my church, I don't know why they came. They came just to welcome us back. Even though you were what you call a real hero, they treated us like heroes. And I just love people and love being around people. So I'm doing what I enjoy doing.
Well, and it's easy to see that that's the case. And you mentioned coming back from Washington. That was with Central Valley Honor Flight. You got to go with 64 other veterans to see the World War II Memorial and some of the other sites in Washington, D.C. What did you glean from that experience? What was the most fulfilling aspect of it for you?
You know, was it this monument or that monument? Not really. You know, I'll tell you the thing that impressed me the most. It's just the fact that there are some people that love America and they appreciate the military. That trip cost thousands of dollars, and it wasn't government money. It was people's money that gave to pay for this trip that I had free. And that made a tremendous impression on me. And then just see God's love through people, like the ones in my church that came out there to just say, hey, welcome home. I think that was the biggest impression I had. But all the memorials, too, was interesting. And I'm thankful for our country that honors thousands and thousands of tombstones out there around Washington. And from the Vietnam War, names by the thousands of people that gave their life. And our country appreciates that. My prayer is that our country will be a country that continues honoring God and putting Him first. And that's my desire for my country.
I've got to ask you, I don't want to be melodramatic, but it comes to my mind, and I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking the same thing. When you got to that World War II memorial and you saw that wall of gold stars representing more than 400,000 Americans that didn't come home from the war, did you find yourself reflecting on all those times you came pretty close to adding to that number?
Oh, yeah, I don't think about it every day, but on occasionally you do. And I just say, thank you, God, for sparing me, because He did a lot. They didn't make it. And I'm thankful for them that they were willing to go.
And I know your son and your daughters and your grandkids and great-grandkids are thankful that you came back, because they wouldn't be here otherwise. Are you proud of your service? Do you feel that you and those 16 million other Americans who served and all the folks back home supporting you, that you accomplished something important during those years?
You know, I think it was important, but I also think that, you know, it was a job just like any other job. You sign up and you you do what the boss tells you to do. So going to Europe, it was a government job. I still think about all the policemen around us in Fresno and everywhere, and sometimes they don't get treated very well, and I think they're the ones that we need to be honored, because I was in harm's way for a few months, but policemen are in harm's way every day for year after year. So I'm thankful for them.
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us a little bit about your experiences. In closing, is there something that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
Well, I'm thankful that I grew up in a Christian home and that my parents told me about Jesus, who died on the cross to save me from hell, which I deserve. I'm just thankful for that, and I'm thankful that God's kept me alive, thankful that he brought me to Fresno, and thankful for all the wonderful Christian people I know in my own church and out of the church, and people like Paul that I've gotten to know today. I just feel honored and blessed.
Well, it's been an honor sharing your story with our audience today. If you want to see what a good-looking soldier George Hansen was 70 years ago and what he looks like today, check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. We're out of time today. Thank you very much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. If you're still listening here on the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com, you've heard a little bit that didn't quite fit into our radio time, and here's a little more for you, something you've heard me ask other guests on the show over the years, and Mr. Hansen has his own unique perspective on it. I also have to ask you, and maybe this is more selfish than anything else, anytime I meet someone who's had a long-lasting marriage, it's kind of fun to get their advice, and I've heard it all. What would you say would be the secret of your marriage?
I think the secret is that when we got married, we were married as two Christians. We've always believed that God needs to be first in our family, and I had a wonderful wife. 64 years of a wonderful marriage with our trials and decisions. But I believe that both of us wanted to honor God in our lives. And I know that a marriage without the Lord, he's not only our Savior, he's our guide and our God and the one that helps and directs our path. And when I look back on my life to see how God just opened things and closed things, he was guiding us. And I think every marriage needs to be a marriage where you include God in all your decisions. I just keep coming back to that Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. There are three things we do. We trust God and include him in our plans, and he says he will direct our path. So no matter where you are, if you trust God and include him in your plans, he will show you the way.